Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Today on the show, I have an incredibly special guest, Amanda Knox. Amanda is an exoneree, journalist, public speaker, and author of the best-selling memoir, Waiting to be Heard. Between 2007 and 2015, Amanda spent nearly 4 years in an Italian prison and 8 years on trial for a murder she didn't commit. The controversy over Amanda's case made international headlines for nearly a decade and unwillingly thrust her into the spotlight, where she was vilified and shamed. Amanda now works to shed light on the issues of wrongful conviction, truth-seeking, and public shaming. Her essays and journalism have been published in major publications like USA Today, the LA Times, the Atlantic, the Independent, the Free Press, the Seattle Times, and Seattle Magazine. Amanda is also the co-host of the podcast Labyrinths. In Labyrinths, Amanda and her co-host Christopher Robinson delve into stories of getting lost and found again through compassionate interviews, philosophical rants, and playful debate with fascinating people. I invited Amanda on my show to talk about a five-part series she did in her Labyrinths podcast titled Blood Money. Blood Money looks at the history and evolution of true crime content and the many ethical dilemmas that appear when creating and consuming true crime. I was so grateful that Amanda agreed to come on the podcast to talk about how the series came about, her personal struggles of her own story being exploited by content creators, and how we can all strive to be more ethical when creating and consuming true crime. If you want to see the video version of Amanda and I's conversation, you can find it exclusively on my Patreon at patreon.com/Tyler Hooper. It's only $5 a month to subscribe. You can also access the ad and sponsor-free audio version of this episode by signing up for the Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and on the Facebook page to get there. Finally, if you enjoy this pod and this episode, consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your support is greatly appreciated. Now, here's my interview with Amanda. Well, thanks for coming on the show to talk about the ethics of true crime.
Of course.
I thought a good place to start was obviously with you, given what you've been through. I imagine for a lot of people listening and perhaps watching that when they hear the name Amanda Knox, they might think of the Netflix documentary they've seen or maybe read your book, but maybe they don't think about you, the person. And I'm wondering, and I know this is kind of a leading question, but I'm wondering, did you feel dehumanized going through your trial and your ordeal? And at the time, were you conscious of that, or was that something that sunk in later, you know, as you were kind of processing everything that had happened to you?
great question and kind of the heart of the matter of the whole discussion, really. I would say that I felt dehumanized throughout the entire process in the sense that I felt rendered into this two-dimensional cutout character, this idea of a person more than an actual person. And that was revealed to me in various layers, because it's one thing to be dehumanized by the police, and then it's another thing to be dehumanized in the courtroom, and then it's another thing to be dehumanized by the local media, and then it's a whole other, you know, it's a, another layer of it is being dehumanized by the international media. And I had varying stages of confronting that dehumanization, and it always, always, always was shocking to me. I always assumed going in when I was encountering other human beings that I would be registered as another human being. And I was consistently shocked to find how much people, even people who came in direct contact with me, you know, lawyers or other inmates even who were following the case, they had this idea of a person that was in their heads, and it was preventing them from encountering me as a real human being, a person who has a history, a person who has hopes and dreams, a person who is suffering. I was this object for a lot of people, and it was an object of debate, an object of entertainment, an object of loathing, an object of lusting. It was gross all around, I'll have to say. And it was one of those reasons why it started me on this long process of trying to understand how it is possible that we as human beings are capable of doing the harm of dehumanization to each other in real time like that, even when we come face to face with each other. I know that, for instance, the vast majority of the people who have ever heard of me have not come into person-to-person contact with me. So the feelings that I have about being dehumanized by them are different than the feelings that I have about being dehumanized by the police, say. So,
yeah. And that's, I wanted to be careful doing this interview too, not to almost juxtapose what I'm trying to do here and, you know, solely talk about you and your ordeal, because I know it's been told to death, like you've said. But I do want to get your perspective on what it was like the first time you saw your story told to you, you know, whether, I don't know what medium it was, if it was a documentary or maybe like a feature news piece. But like, do you remember that moment, like the first time you saw, like, beyond like just a little news clip, like a cohesive narrative that maybe you had nothing to do with, and like what that was like? Like, I must have, it must have felt surreal and jarring and a whole bunch of
feelings. I mean, the first one, it was probably looking at seeing local media in Italy. But at the time, there wasn't really a coherent narrative happening. It was just a lot of like scandal, this news, that news. And a lot of it was just made up, or a lot of it was confusing and contradictory. And so the first time that I really got a full narrative was when the prosecution was doing their closing arguments, basically in the first trial. And they, it's still scandalous to this day. I don't know if you know about this little like fun nugget about my case, but the prosecution spent an inordinate amount of money. I think it was like something around 700,000 euro or something like that, something astronomical and unreasonable and frankly irresponsible to the public who was paying for it. They spent that money in order to make a 3D like video, like digital representation of the crime, where they had like a digital version of me stabbing Meredith to death. Like they had this little video, and they brought it to the courtroom to present to the jury so they could understand, like, so they could get the visual of what the prosecution was talking about. And it, I mean, one, it was just, this was back in 2009. So of course it was not like even uncanny valley. It was just bad. But it was also horrible because it really showed how much the prosecution was relying on narrative as opposed to evidence to make their case. And yet, they're the only ones who came to the courtroom with a beautiful little video just displaying the scene, like the crime scene. And here's how the crime occurred. And here's Meredith screaming. And here's Rudy Gadea and Raffaele holding her down. And here's Amanda wearing a shirt. They had me wearing a shirt that I had worn in court. Like they like modeled this Amanda character off of me wearing like the clothes I was wearing in the courtroom. And it so that was utterly surreal. And then, of course, you know, there's all of the versions that happen. I remember when I was first released, I hadn't really been in contact with any of the international media about the case. I had seen a little bit how it was portrayed in Italy. A lot of it was talk shows. A lot of it was news reports, that kind of thing. But then I came home after being acquitted and I saw the, you know, 2020 specials that were about my case, or I finally saw the Lifetime film that was, you know, based on a true story, part of the case, and seeing the Amanda Knox character sort of, there's this one scene where she's like adjusting her boobs. And I was just like, oh my God, this is what the world thinks I am. And it, the way that I've talked about it in the past is it's like there's a doppelganger version of yourself that exists in the world that is what everyone thinks is the real you. And every time you walk into a room, it's almost as if the doppelganger version of you was just in there, just making a fool of herself. And she just walked out and you just walked in. And now you're left with the consequences. You're left with the mess to clean up. You're left with the weird stares or, you know, the titters. I felt like there was this weird shadow version of me that was making me look like a fool in the world. And I was, there was nothing I could do. There was no way that I could say, no, that's just my evil twin that you guys saw. It's not me. Like it was to them, it was me. To them, it was my name. It was my face. And therefore it was my problem. And I mean, I can talk about what the consequences of that were for me personally, which I think is one of your questions.
Yeah. Like I think the consequences and like how it changed you, I can't imagine it. You know, obviously the entire trial and ordeal would change a person, but then the public life that you were forced into afterwards, like, yeah, tell me about all of that.
Yeah. So it made me, so, okay, backing up slightly. Throughout my ordeal in Italy, especially throughout my imprisonment in Italy, I was very isolated from the rest of humanity, right? I'm literally isolated. I'm in a cell. I can't go outside these prison walls. I can only talk to a select few people who have been authorized by the prison system. And so my view of the world was very small. I had a very small window into the world. And honestly, my biggest concern while I was in prison was not what is my public image out there. It is surviving the prison environment. So when I was released, I had this years-long sort of fantasy about getting to go back to my own life. Like I was living in prison and I felt like I was living somebody else's life by mistake. And I was just waiting for the opportunity to be given my life back. And then the sort of rude awakening that I arrived home to was that I did no longer have that life that I had been waiting to live anymore. I was no longer an anonymous college student. I was this idea of a person, Amanda Knox, and I was the girl accused of murder, and that was never going to go away. There were paparazzi following me around everywhere. They were camped outside of my mom's house. They were camped outside of my apartment. So for months, years even, I wasn't sure if I wasn't being stalked all the time by people who were reporting on the case. And so that led me to experience a deep sense of both like justified paranoia and deep isolation from the rest of humanity. So while I was no longer in a prison cell, I certainly did not feel like I belonged to everybody else. I felt deeply, deeply isolated under the spotlight. I I went from being the kind of person who would ride the bus and smile at strangers and say good morning, like, how are you doing, strike up conversations, to being deeply withdrawn and deeply mistrustful of even when people were nice to me, because I wasn't sure if they were just trying to get close to me in order to exploit or hurt me. There were people in my, there was a kid in my math class. I went back to college and there was a kid in my math class who posted to his friends on like some snowboarding, like Reddit site or something like that, about how I was in his class and he was going to try to get close to me so he could like rape me and pee in my butt is what he said he wanted to do. Yeah. And so it's like, it's stuff like that where it's like, I have justified paranoia. I don't know what the vision of me that any single person has in their mind. And I retreated back to only talking to or having relationships with people who I already knew prior to going to Italy, which gratefully, you know, I have a big family. I have lots of friends. But even that proved to be not just easy, because over the course of going through this experience, I was changed. I had gone through something that no one else in my family had gone through. And so in certain ways, I also felt estranged from the people I loved and the people who loved me. So I felt very alone for a very long time. And it's taken a lot of processing and a lot honestly encountering other wrongfully convicted people for me to feel like I have a place in the world and within humanity again, that I'm not just like singled out.
Yeah. And I wonder too, like, and to no fault, I don't think anyone would fault you for this if you did run and hide away and want to just get away from it all. But instead, you've seemed to kind of push back and become an advocate. And I'm wondering, like, it sounds like maybe that was a gradual process. I mean, what's been driving you to keep giving back and being an advocate for those who are wrongfully accused or going through something similar that you went through?
Yeah, that's a great question, because my impulse when I discovered this insane reality that I had come home to was to hide. I just wanted to be left alone. I didn't want the girl accused of murder to be my legacy. But I also didn't feel like there was anything I could do about it. So I went into hiding. I went back to school. I got a minimum wage job at a bookstore that was literally underground. And I started writing for a local newspaper under a pseudonym. So I was very much like incognito as much as I possibly could. And it wasn't until I went to my first ever Innocence Network conference, which is a yearly annual conference where all these innocence projects throughout the United States and also throughout the world come together in one location to share resources and stories and meet each other. I was invited to go there when I was still on trial, but here in the United States. So I had been acquitted, but I was put back on trial. I actually had already been reconvicted. So I was in the like potentially fighting extradition process, and I was invited, and I personally didn't want to go because I felt like what I was walking into was a room full of hundreds of strangers who would recognize me. And that was not what I wanted in my life. But my mom insisted that I go, and she drove me down to Portland is where it was taking place that year. And, you know, these conference centers, they're just like, you know, bad lighting and gaudy carpets and quote ballrooms. And I walked into one of those ballrooms and there were hundreds of people there, and I was immediately recognized. So again, kind of my worst nightmare, except the people who recognized me were these two men who immediately rushed over to me and gave me a really big hug and said, "You don't have to explain a thing to me, little sister. We know." And they were two men who had both been wrongly convicted. Each of them had spent at least a decade in prison for crimes that they did not commit. And they were my introduction into this space of this, not just this space, this sort of tribe, this family of people who were spread out across the United States and around the world who had this one thing in common. And it meant everything to us to know that we existed for each other, that we didn't have to explain ourselves to each other. Like, that was one of the things that was so difficult for me, was because I had been through this extreme experience, I felt like I was constantly having to explain myself to people. And in this group of people, I did not have to explain a thing. They already knew. And it was such a relief. And I was shocked because I had no idea these people existed. Like, I went over to Italy and I was put through my own wrongful conviction experience. And I thought I might be one of the only people in the world that this was ever happening to, as far as I knew. Like, I was not a true crime person. I did not have any experience with the criminal justice system. And so I really was raised with this idea that the police are the good guys, the bad guys are the bad guys, they go to jail. And I just happened to be mistaken for one of them. And then I was sort of plunged into this reality where I realized, oh, no, no, this problem is much bigger than me. It's a systemic problem. It's impacting a lot more people than we realize. And one thing I realized was that I sort of stood out, because here I was, this college-educated white girl in a room full of mostly men, and mostly men who came from poor backgrounds, who were men of color. And yet we were a family, and they were there to take care of me. And one of the things that I realized was that there is a lot of these people in this world, in this innocence advocacy world, they know, like, they've all been there. They've seen it a million times. They're fighting the criminal justice system left and right. They're trying to do right by people who have been harmed. But, like, their stories exist within a very specific subsection of society. Mm-hmm. And the subsection that I had come from had no idea. And I realized that there was an opportunity there for me to be a bridge between this community that was deeply entrenched in this really important work and the rest of us who had no freaking clue that it was even happening.
Right.
And I leaned into my sort of background in creative writing, my background in just interest in human stories, and pursued it from there. I just sort of figured out that here was this intersection between my experience and my skill set. And I just felt like I finally felt like I had some sort of purpose and direction when a lot of that had been taken away from me because of the whole ordeal.
That's incredible. And it sounds like a really strong support group in some ways, right?
Oh, my God. You have no idea. I mean, yeah. Maybe you have an idea. Maybe you have a support group of people. But, like, this is not like just friends.
Right.
Right. Like, the thing that's so interesting about this group of people is we don't see each other very often. We don't, like, it's not, you know, like Friends, the TV show, where we all are in apartments next to each other. It's not like that. It's very often we go a whole year without seeing each other. We may only see each other at this specific event. A lot of us do keep in touch beyond that, but, like, we're spread out far and wide. So it's not like we see each other very often. And yet, And also, we are very different. We, like, this group of people is culturally very different, economically very different. They're very different in terms of, like, religion, education, like, all of these different factors make us, like, the most disparate group of people that you could think of, politically different. Like, and yet, this thing that, like, took over all of our lives is made us feel so intimate with each other. Wow. In a way that it's hard to explain, like, the level of, like, trust and care and genuine love that we have for each other, even if we don't have anything else in common, is really special. That's all I can say, I guess.
No, that's a lot. And that's really, really well said. I wanted to go back to something you said right before that about kind of having a creative output for all of this and using that for good and for advocacy. And maybe I'm connecting dots here. But I feel like maybe Labyrinth and your podcast and the series Blood Money were part of that, which I loved the series. That's why I reached out to want to do this, listening to your five-part series. I'm wondering, like, maybe it's an obvious question, but was there like a driving impetus behind Blood Money in the series, or was it just kind of like everything had come to a point where like I need to put it in, you know, like a serial kind of platform to get this all out and get all this information out? Like, what, how did that come together?
Well, the ethics of true crime and media around ethics or around true crime stories has been an issue that I've been thinking and processing for a very long time. And I've written about it. I've done different series about it. Like, even before Labyrinths, I had the Scarlet Letter Reports and I had The Truth About True Crime. And all of these were engaging with these issues. I've written about it extensively in The Atlantic and Medium. And like, so this is a topic that is deeply of interest to me, because I felt like nobody was talking coherently about this issue. There was this sense of entitlement on the part of content creators to tell these stories. There was a sense of complete helplessness on the part of the people who were the content of those content creators. And I learned from having experience in this world, seeing the good, the bad, and the ugly of media representation, that disconnect between the content creators and their sources was both unnecessary and unethical in no uncertain terms. And I was curious to know why that was happening. I was curious to know what the history was behind that. And it led me down this road. And the real catalyst for the Blood Money series was actually finding myself in the middle of a true crime ethical dilemma, which didn't ultimately make it into the series because it was determined by everyone involved that it was better kept private. But that there was this really interesting dilemma that I found myself in where I was in the crosshairs between two separate sides of this debate. And I was attempting to sort of mitigate or like to mediate these two factions in a sort of learning and productive way. And that pushed me to then start asking those questions really deliberately of content creators, of historians, like bringing all of these perspectives together at one table to really just dissect what is going on here. Does it really need to be the way that it is today? Are there other models for how true crime can be consumed? And if so, like, how do we get there? And that was the goal behind Blood Money. So I'm glad it spoke to you. It was a interesting journey for me.
Yeah, it really spoke to me. I have a history background as well. It's always fascinated me. So, you know, to open the series with kind of the historical context of the ethics of true crime, I mean, it was surprising, but I guess I wasn't ultimately shocked because the way you laid it out, it's like, well, of course, it's evolved through hundreds of years. It didn't just start up recently.
Yeah, the history of true crime has been hiding in plain sight this entire time.
Absolutely. And it's incredible how far back it goes. And I think you even say, or someone says in the podcast, like it peaked, you know, in the 19th century, there was a peak, which is, you know, quite a while ago. We don't have to spend too much time on this because people can listen to the series, but I do want to touch on, because, you know, we're going to talk about how it impacts people today and how it has and sort of where ethics are right now. But I think also if we look back to the 19th century, you know, crimes happened, people were committed or accused of such crimes, and their lives were impacted by the coverage of that. And I'm wondering, like, you know, the instance that you talk about, and you've written about this online as well, as I think it's the English man, John Thurtell, who's like accused of, I think it's murdering someone over a gambling debt, if I recall.
That's right. Yes. He owed a gambling debt to an innkeeper, but he was convinced that the innkeeper had, you know, cheated. And so he decided that he was going to murder the innkeeper instead of actually pay the debt.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, can you tell us, like, because that case got some coverage, you know, and like, what was
the impact of that? Oh, it got a lot of coverage.
Yeah. Like, what was the impact on his outcome and the trial and whatnot?
I mean, I think the thing that is most interesting about this is at the time, it was not considered out of line for there to be not just media coverage of the case as it was happening in court, but also plays written about it and performed, and, you know, these little booklets that would describe, like, oh, what did he say to him as he, like, shot him in the face and then, you know, slit his throat. Like, this public interest wasn't just in the facts of the case itself, but it was in the scenario, the narrative. And people really wanted to have as much access to that narrative. They wanted the novel version. They wanted the play version. They wanted to see it with their own eyes. And so, and there was the sense of entitlement to do that. There were, you know, things that the public couldn't have absolutely no knowledge of were just made up. I think that's the thing that's really super interesting about the history of this is people for either the reasons to sell a story or to moralize around a story felt completely comfortable just making stuff up about it. And like another great example of this is super, super early stuff. So before it was like crimes were being reported on per se, there were church people who would want to write little essays or sermons about crimes that were taking place in their community. And they would also just completely make shit up. Like they would, if a mother was accused of like smothering her children to death, like the church, you know, would write, or like the clergyman would write his own little pamphlet where he would describe the scene of the children begging their mother not to kill them and offering their toys as like alternative victims, and like just like painting this scenario so that not so much so that the world could get the truth, but so that a moral lesson could be made of this like current circumstance. And they felt completely comfortable doing that, which is fascinating to me. And as time goes on, we see how not only are these true crime stories sort of taken and elevated in this narrative way, in this sort of fantasy way, for the sake of moralizing, but also just for the sake of its own romanticization. It's just for the sake of like the number of outlaws in our, you know, Western history of like Billy the Kids and all of these people who were literally just murderers and thugs who were romanticized and elevated to heroic status because it was profitable to sell this kind of Western romance. And also to sort of have that anchoring, there was something about it being based on a true story that really made it so appealing to people. It made it feel like there was something titillating and even aspirational to it. It's not, you know, a knight in shining armor battling a dragon. It's like, this is something that I can really relate to. Because it's real life, I think, is what people, and also we're just sort of feeding into that sort of gossip machine that really digs down into our deep evolutionary psychology of like wanting to gossip, wanting to identify in groups and out groups, wanting to judge others, because it has an evolutionary and survival advantage to us.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
You mentioned something, a phrase or a disclaimer that is, it's ubiquitous when it comes to entertainment being released now, I think. I see it everywhere, based on a true story.
Mm-hmm.
That is something, and this isn't in the questions, but it's well, exactly. And I wonder, there is an entitlement with that phrase by creators to use someone's like real events and then pad them with, sensationalism to sell a product. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is entertainment at the end of the day, but it can be harmful and entertainment. So this kind of ties into my question. And, you know, I'm wondering what do you think the biggest issue is? And I'm going to just use the phrase Hollywood, because, you know, when we think about like the big movies that come out that are based on true stories that focus on crime, like from your perspective, what is the biggest issue that Hollywood is facing? And, you know, maybe they're choosing to ignore it, but when it comes to telling these stories that are about real people and real events, very traumatic events often, that are, you know, based on a true story. Like, how do you see them handling it? Like, are there issues with that? And like, what would you like to see different? Like, I know, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about your own experience with that, but I know reading online that there's been some films in the last few years that have come out that.
Oh, yeah.
There have been
so many. It's fascinating. Yeah. Like, there have been so many that it gives me the opportunity to say, well, here's how it was done in this case, and that's interesting for this reason, but here's how, you know, like typically with a story, there's like one movie that they make about it, maybe one novel. And in my case, there's just like, I can't count the number of novels or TV shows or movies that have been inspired by or that are based on what I went through. And what I see as being a big problem, even just for documentary series, even if you think about it, is how content creators have a very different incentive structure than an actual person for telling the story. And there's this sense that if you're a content creator, that you have the valid perspective. And the person who is who directly lived through something does not have the valid perspective because they're not objective per se.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would argue is that nobody coming into these stories is ever objective. I would say that everyone is coming in with their subjective experience. And so it's not as if the further you are from the story, the less impact you ever are about the story means that you have the right perspective. And I think that one of the things I would challenge to content creators is to recognize, what is your perspective going into one of these stories? What is your goal? How are you personally impacted by this story? And what are you projecting from your own personal interests and personal experience onto that story? Because that's what you're doing by choosing to tell the story in the first place, and by how you frame it, and, you know, by what story you want to tell. And I would say, don't underestimate the perspective of the person who is your subject, because it very well could be that they've had to process the story, like the experience, much more than you have, and they understand its implications and its broader implications potentially more than you do. But beyond that, I think one of the problems with Hollywood in this case is the monetization of scandal. Because it's one thing to be inspired by a story. Like, there's a really great example of this in my own situation, which is Anatomy of a Fall is a movie that just recently came out. It's been very critically acclaimed. Apparently, it was inspired by my story. Now, you wouldn't know that ahead of time because the context or of the story is this wife is accused of pushing her husband out of a window. And the question that is being debated over the course of the story is, did she push him or did he commit suicide and jump? And so that on its surface, you think, OK, I don't see Amanda Knox there. Like, this is not her roommate. This is not like this is not a rape and, you know, stabbing, killing. Like, all of the details have been changed enough that it's not recognizable as the Amanda Knox story. No one watching that movie is thinking, oh, Amanda Knox. Or if they are, it's more of like this more subtle things that were a part of that story that do have resonance. And it those things might be how the female character's sexuality was raised as a way to render her a less savory individual to the attorney or to the jury. The fact that she was in a foreign country for her. So she was felt like an outsider. The fact that people didn't think that she reacted the way that a normal grieving person would react. And I would say, potentially, the ending is left a little bit ambiguous. So there is, I think, one of the things that people think of when they think of my story is they come away thinking, well, we'll never know the truth. And of course, like, that a little bit bugs me because I think that it's very easy to see what the truth is in my case. But there is, when people think of this case or my case, a lot of people think there's an ambiguous ending. Maybe there's more to the story that never got revealed and we'll never know. And that was a little bit the vibe that was at the end of Anatomy of a Fall. But I would say that of all of the products that have ever been inspired by what happened to me, that was the most thoughtfully done because it was not lazy. It didn't just turn Italy into France and, you know, vaguely, like, you know, change a name or two. Like, it was, there have been very, very lazy fictionalizations based on a true story. Like, you know, Stillwater is a good example of this. I was referencing Stillwater by saying France and changing a few names.
I picked up on that.
But Stillwater was like, it was attempting to be a smart, thoughtful movie. Apparently Matt Damon even went out of his way to go and hang out with people in rural, you know, the rural Midwest so he could really like convey their, you know, their humanity in its fullest proportions. And yet nobody thought to reach out to anyone in my family or me personally, who was very obviously being depicted in the film, even if by another name. And I think that what the sort of creators of that film would say is, well, we were obviously, you know, inspired by Amanda's story, but it's not Amanda's story. And I would say, well, if it's not Amanda's story, then why do I see you using my name to promote the film everywhere? And why is it that everyone who watches the film is like, oh, this is obviously about Amanda Knox? Because if you really were truly fictionalizing it, you would not, that would not be the takeaway. Like, it would be the takeaway that Anatomy of a Fall does, where it's not, it's very odd, like enough details have been changed that it's a whole new story. And really what you're doing is taking the implications of a real life story and reimagining them in a whole new scenario. That is not what Stillwater did. Stillwater just changed a few names, moved a few locations around, but it was still the same story. And it was a version of the story that had implications for me personally, because people came away from watching Stillwater going, oh, maybe that's what happened in real life in the Amanda Knox case. And that means that now suddenly I am left with the problem or the consequences of people believing something that was fictionalized. And that is the continual problem of fictionalizations. And then you have the problem of even like based on a true story. So the Lifetime one, Lifetime is an example where they still used my name. And so it was very based on a true story, meant to represent reality, but it was representing reality through the lens of entertainment. It was representing, quote, reality by leaning in to the scandal and leaning in to the elements of the case that raised the most eyebrows. And it wasn't leaning into what was most true or what was most provable. And so that's where you see, again, problems, messes, confusion, muddied waters that they get to walk away from, but that I have to live with for the rest of my life. And I think that's the thing that I would love Hollywood to consider is that they make a movie and it takes a few years for them to go through the process of making a movie. They hope they get an award or two. They hope they make some money and then they move on with their lives. And then those of us who are the source material do not. And how they tell our story has a very direct impact on how we get to live our lives moving forward.
Yeah. And I think the impact is really important to highlight. To me, there's like a pretty clear schism between, you know, helpful true crime entertainment and exploitive. And I think exploitive is a fair term. I thought about it. I was like, is that too harsh? And then after listening to your podcast and with my own experiences, exactly. I was like, no,
that's just the right word.
Yeah, exactly. And it is because people are making profit off of other people's traumatic stories and events that have happened to them. And I do want to get into the aspect near the end here about the re-traumatization that comes with that. But I'm wondering, I mean, maybe this is too ambiguous of a question, but is there a line to be drawn between that helpful and exploitive from your experience, I guess? Because, I mean, it's harder for someone like myself who hasn't had that to clearly see if there is. I mean, I have my own morals and values that can guide that based on, you know, just what I believe. And then I guess maybe this is also seems obvious, but, you know, are there any big benefits to telling these so-called true crime stories?
I mean, there are obviously benefits to it because there have been cases that have been reopened and justice that was sort of that it was delivered to people who had been waiting decades of their life to have someone revisit this case with a new and open perspective. So I think the biggest thing that would I think content creators should ask themselves when they are about to approach one of these stories is consider what they are bringing to the table in by telling the story itself. So is it the case that they're just rehashing the same stuff that people have already done? They're not bringing anything new to the table. What they're doing is they're just reopening some wounds for people for the sake of getting to have their say about it. Like the number of podcasts that are doing just that, where they're not actually bringing anything new to the table. There's no reason for them to be doing the podcast other than to do it. Or there's no reason for the Discovery Channel to be doing their episode about it, except so that they can have their episode about it and they know that some people are going to watch it. Like if you have no new perspective or no new evidence or no new if there's nothing that is being gained for the sake of the case itself or the people involved directly impacted, then I would say, I don't think you got a good reason to be doing it. Because it just sounds like you just want this opportunity. Basically, you're leaning on someone else's real life trauma in order to tell a story. And you know what? There are infinite stories out there in the world to tell. And you can make up your own story. Just make up a story. You know, like you don't have to lean on someone's worst experience to tell a story and be a storyteller. So unless you have something that you are bringing to the table that is going to make people more empathize with the experience or uncover new information or put it into a more historical, broader perspective. Like, I think that's a really interesting thing is when you see cases being that we thought we knew, but now looking back 20 years later, we're like, oh my gosh, now I realize with some hindsight that there was a lot of political or social things going on that obviously impacted the case in a way that we couldn't see at the time. Mm-hmm. Like, these are important ways to tell stories. Telling the story just for the sake of telling the story because you know people are going to listen to it because it's interesting, I guess, is not worth it. Just tell a different story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of what you're saying, this is kind of this word keeps popping into my head as we're having this conversation. And this is from a creator perspective, is intent. Like, what is my intent with this? Because, you know, there have definitely been thoughts where I've seen a case and I'm like, you know, is my intent, and I've struggled with this, but I've had the thought where it's like, is my intent here to cover this because I want to bring awareness, or is it because, you know, ad revenue next month will look a little bit better, right?
Like, uh-huh.
And there's that comes with it as well. And, you know, I started my own podcast, you know, with the former thought of being like, well, I want to bring awareness for families and people of missing persons primarily who don't get exposure all the time, you know, right. Use my journalism background to do that.
And missing person cases are so great for that because on the one hand, you can sort of look over and over again at the same, like some mm-hmm. missing person cases are so tragic because there's been no leads for mm-hmm. like 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's, you're just mulling over the same stuff, chewing over the same material over and over again and getting nowhere. But at the same time, like, it's still an open case mm-hmm. and something may be around the corner that might lead to some important revelation that might mm-hmm. bring closure to people who are still suffering. Like that, you know, those are great examples of cases that could be covered responsibly.
Yeah. And I think too, like, just from my own journalism background, I know too, like, unless they're already, you know, really popularized, or there's an anniversary date, like, they don't get a lot of coverage, you know, they tend to, especially as the years goes by. So that was also the intent, like, you know, maybe someone listening will have some information or be able to provide something that will give the family or the police some sort of lead. So, mm-hmm. But going back to kind of, I want to talk about some of the pitfalls too, because the biggest fear that I have as a creator, whenever I'm going to interview someone, even if they've consented and it's, you know, well, they always consent, but even if, you know, they seem enthusiastic to do it, I'm always like, I don't want to re-traumatize them because mm-hmm. they are reliving, you know, some of the worst days and moments of their lives. Mm-hmm. Listening to a lot of true crime content, I don't think a lot of creators understand that. Like, I don't mm-hmm. think they understand how, first of all, how trauma works mm-hmm. and how easily it is for people to feel re-traumatized. And I guess the question here is, like, as a content creator, is that kind of line of thinking of whether we're going to re-traumatize someone, is that our responsibility, or is it the responsibility of the person who's accepting the interview to take that on and understand that maybe that's going to be a part of the experience of sharing their story, or is it a shared responsibility? Like, I'm curious how you see that.
So in an ideal world, a person walking into an interview to tell the story of the worst experience of their life would be 100% educated on mm-hmm. how they're going to be impacted by the telling of their story. They would have already processed their experience with a therapist. mm-hmm. They would know, like, what story they are ready to tell. And they would be in partnership with a storyteller whose interest would be in helping them tell their story in the most truest way to them that at the same time, like, does the work of getting the material that you need to tell a story. Because, mm-hmm. like, frankly, you know, I also face this problem. It's like, if I'm going to be interviewing somebody about, you know, a rape accusation, say, like, mm-hmm. is it rape porn if I'm asking them to really, like, get down to the details of what we're talking about here? And I would say that it is a tightrope that content creators have to walk, because we do not live in that ideal world. The vast majority of people who have had horrendous experiences happen to them are in no way educated or prepared to tell their story in the way that is best for them. Like, they need the experience of telling their story to someone to even know what it is that they're trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And I've had this experience where I have been interviewed, like, in the early days of doing interviews, I felt re-traumatized and exploited, because, in large part, because I didn't know what power I had as a storyteller. As like, I didn't feel like the story was even really my own to tell, because I was sort of at the mercy of the people asking the questions. I felt like I was still in the police interrogation room, where the police were the ones who were in charge of the story, and I was not. I was sort of at their mercy, and I was at their disposal in the hopes that they would get it right. And I didn't realize that I myself had the power to say, you know what? That question is completely irrelevant. Let me tell you what is important about this story. The number of times that I've now like see red flags of things that are about to happen to other people, where it's like, you know, when content creators say, I'm going to have to ask you the question of, did you molest your daughter? Even though there's no evidence that you did, just because people have speculated about it, like, I would push back and say, I don't think you actually have to ask that question.
100%.
Because if you have no evidence of, or in the case with my case, for instance, like, I, you know, had the Chris Cuomos of the world asking me if I was into deviant sex. And it was like, you know what? That's actually not relevant to this case. So no, you don't have to ask me that question just because people are titillated by the idea that I might be into deviant sex.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's there's no evidence of me physically being there in the room where my friend was sexually assaulted. So no, like, you don't have any reason to think that I had anything to do with any sexual like assault at all. And, you know, like it was leaning in again. It was that leaning into the scandal, the titillating, instead of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I mean, there are people out there who are attempting to resolve this problem. Like, there's this, I recommend reaching out to a woman named Lenora Claire, who is really smart and is attempting actually to start a company that would be in the service of people who are the subject matters, and they would be hired by production companies as this extra layer of support between the production company and the source person, that would educate the production company about how to ethically interview somebody who had been through a traumatic experience, be it a victim of crime or a victim of the criminal justice system. Lenora Claire is a victim of a crime, for instance. She was stalked. And she had a very bad media coverage of that case that she felt was exploitative of her. But she came from the entertainment industry. And so she knew that it wasn't necessarily that the media was all bad guys and they were just trying to traumatize people.
Right.
They just didn't know better. They didn't know. And so, like, it's all a matter of all of us becoming a little bit more educated. On the content creator side, educated about trauma. On the traumatized person side, educated about media, and hopefully coming to a place where it's less of a exploitation and more of a collaboration.
That's so well put. And I don't even think I need to ask you the next question, which is like, how can creators of true crime, you know, be more ethical? I think education is probably the blanket answer, right? Like,
learn about trauma, learn about, you know, how any one story that you want to tell fits into the broader scope of the stories that are similar to it or that are already out there, and be willing to be vulnerable yourself. Because if you're asking your, you know, this person who you're going to be interviewing or whose story you're going to tell to be vulnerable and to expose themselves, like, recognize that that is to be reciprocated. And there is some collaboration there between yourself and the person. I found that as a content creator, like, the best conversations I have are ones where I'm willing to open myself up to the person as much as they open themselves up to me. And that creates better content, and it creates better experiences for the people whose stories are told, because they feel like they were really genuinely heard. And and also, I think one of the things that I would say to content creators is be willing to walk away. Because, like, I have absolutely had times where I have worked with somebody to help tell their story and, like, worked hard and at length with somebody. And then by the end of it, they had second thoughts and they decided they didn't want to go through with it. And instead of saying, well, you signed the contract, so it's too bad, I just said, okay. And we didn't put it out. And it, like, the content that you're creating doesn't need to exist. Let's put some humility out there. Nobody who is ever creating content anywhere needs their content to exist. So start from there and then and then like work your way up.
That's great advice. I know we're getting close on time, but I wanted to ask you, I wanted to end with this question because obviously people will be listening to this. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about creators and how they can be more ethical in the choices they make when they're creating their content. I'm wondering, do you have any thoughts or advice for people listening who aren't creators, who are just consumers of true crime content? And I guess maybe in this case, you know, well, you don't have to focus on podcasts for your answer, but yeah, like what advice or thoughts would you give them on more ethically consuming true crime content?
I mean, I think it would be curious about how the sausage gets made because and sort of measure the value of the content that you're creating, not just by how titillated you are by it, but by the impact that it's going to have on the directly impacted people involved. And be curious about whether or not they consented to the project or they were a part of the project, or and resist sort of just accepting easy black and white stories. And instead look for content that is willing to get into uncomfortable spaces and admit that it doesn't know. I think the more humble and honest the content, the better it is anyway, because I think it really does get down into the nitty gritty of like human nature. And also just like recognize that, like, again, if it's based on a true story, that means that there's a real person out there whose life is still being impacted by the telling of it and the consuming of it. So just ask yourself if it's worth it.
Thanks for listening to my interview with Amanda Knox. If you want to see the video version of Amanda and I's conversation, you can find it exclusively on the Patreon by subscribing for as little as $5 a month. When you sign up, you'll get early access to every new episode of the podcast, which is ad and sponsor free on Patreon, and exclusive content like the video recording of this interview. If you don't want to make a monthly commitment, but you still want to support the podcast, you can buy me a coffee at the link in the description. And if you don't want to spend any money, no worries. You can support the podcast by leaving me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your pods. Once again, I want to thank Amanda for coming on the show and sharing her thoughts and feelings with the ethics of true crime. Thanks for listening to the Missing and Unexplained podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.